5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Hello, it's Jen Taub. Welcome back to Booked Up, a podcast that features you, me, and our favorite authors. We release a new episode every Sunday morning. Today, my guest is Michael Lewis, author of Going Infinite, The Rise and Fall of a New Tycoon. This is the new book about Sam Bankman-Fried, the crypto wunderkind who is now on trial on charges including wire fraud, securities fraud, commodities fraud, and money laundering. Though Michael needs no introduction, I will offer one anyway. You know him from his numerous best-selling works of narrative nonfiction. You may, in fact, be someone like John Williams of the New York Times Book Review, who wrote, "I would read an 800-page history of the stapler if he wrote it." I'm certain that I would as well, and not just because my preliminary research actually indicates that the stapler's origin is somewhat controversial. But actually, I should not digress. What drew me to Michael's writing initially were his Follow the Money books. These include his debut work, Liar's Poker, about binge-eating bond traders on Wall Street in the 1980s, as well as The Big Short, published in 2010, about a scrappy selection of investors who saw that the toxic mortgage-linked securities bubble was about to burst and made billions on the related trades. Several of Michael's books have been made into feature films, including The Big Short, directed by Adam McKay, as well as Moneyball and The Blind Side. What keeps me reading Michael's work are the unexpected discoveries about the fragility of our government infrastructure, such as with The Fifth Risk, and more recently, his now already controversial and very nuanced take on Sam Bankman-Fried. Let's dive in. So, anything new happening in your life?
Not much. It's kind of quiet out there. I published a book 4 days ago. About a...
Oh, you write? You're a writer? That's so cool.
Yeah, no, it's a little thing I do on the side. Mainly, I'm a softball coach and a basketball coach, but and a bon vivant. I'm very social. But
I like bon vivant. That's always nice. But you coach softball?
In my career, I've coached. Yeah, I've spent an awful lot of my time coaching children how to play things that they'd probably be better off not playing after I'm done with them. But it's but yes. So
and so congratulations on the book. Obviously, I have read it. And you are making the book tour rounds for Going Infinite, where you've done, I guess, 60 Minutes and Chris Hayes. What else have you done so far?
So this is has been a little bit of an unusual tour, in that we 60 Minutes did a big takeout on the book on Sunday, but the deal was it had to be embargoed. And so the book was just not like hidden from people until nobody's really had a chance to read it until kind of now. And so I came out of my cave on Monday and did CBS This Morning and three or four radio shows and Chris Hayes and Fareed Zakaria and NPR and I don't know. It's like, and I'm off. I'm now in Washington. Event at the Washington Post last night. With my friend David Shipley, who is the opinion editor there, and I'm off to London tomorrow. And I go to London and Manchester and Dublin, and then Miami and New Orleans and Los Angeles and Portland.
So you're literally in that part of the book tour where you wake up in the middle of the night and you're not sure where you are?
you know, that does happen. What happens more often with me is I wake up in the middle of the night and I wish I was home. You get to a point where I'm not there yet. I will be there next week. Roundabout Manchester. I'll wonder, what on earth am I doing out here? And why does this have to be this way? And I guess it does have to be this way. Briefly during COVID, it didn't have to be this way. It was kind of fun just going down to your desk and doing every show from your desk. But this is the way it's kind of
been. Yeah, I had a book come out during COVID in late September of 2020. And it was great. It was great for the copy editing process. And it was great for the sitting at my desk going on a book tour process. But that has changed. So are you doing any, besides the Washington Post, are you doing any sort of face-to-face gatherings? Or are these mostly sort of just like, you know, broadcast or cable?
No. I think I have two big events, like 800-person events in London, one in Manchester, one in Dublin. Dublin, I'm in St. Patrick's Cathedral, which is, I've done that before, and it's just a gas. You have an odd relationship with the audience because it's so long and narrow. It's like talking in sharks. You know, it's this big, I guess it's Gothic, but it feels Gothic, cathedral. Right. And it's, and so I got one there, and then everywhere else I go, it's face-to-face. In Miami, a big event. Walter Isaacson, the author of a new book about Elon Musk, and I are doing a 2,000-person event in New Orleans, City Arts and Lecture in San Francisco, a big book event in Portland. I have one of them. I have one in Chicago where I don't know how they've done this. They bought 3,000 books, and there are at least 3,000 people going to be there. So it's mostly, it's mostly that it's, there is the media, there's media this week and next, but after that, it's mostly me talking to large numbers of people in some auditorium.
So you chose, an interesting time to, I wouldn't say embed yourself, but to become interested in Sam Bankman-Fried, as well as to release a book, right when he is literally on trial. I'm in the Southern District of New York right now as we speak. I mean, I could be checking my Twitter feed, but I can't multitask like that. And as you can see, I'm not playing a video game. My eyes are darting because I'm looking at my notes on the screen. But and first, let me just begin by saying I love this book.
Thank you.
I hear the criticism that, you know, any book that comes out on any topic, there's going to be positive and negative feedback. And I see this as a piece of the story. And I wonder what do you perceive as, I guess, the greatest strengths of this book? I think the New Yorker review of it that I just read yesterday gets that. And how do you perceive the pushback you're getting, and how do you kind of synthesize all that?
So the book's the story, right? And I had the strengths start with just the level of access I had. And it wasn't just to Sam Bankman-Fried. It was his whole world. And then I was there. I think it's very hard to tell the story unless you had a pretty intimate knowledge of the place before it collapsed. So I had done a kind of pretty thorough reporting job on FTX in the year leading up to the collapse without having written anything of this book. And it gave me a context for what happened. It gave me an ability to communicate after it all collapsed with the principal characters, because they'd gotten to know me and most of them were perfectly happy to continue to talk to me. So having the kind of before and after and having a kind of an on the scenes view of the thing. And especially then after it collapses, kind of still being inside and watching how people are behaving. I don't know. I just felt
so from October, would you say the collapse? Would you
November.
Peg that at like October 2022?
November 2022. So I just had, I'm only as good as my material. This I found long ago. I'm constrained either by what I've not been able to see or hear, or who I've not been able to talk to. Also constrained by just like how the literary quality of the characters. And I felt that this was a case where I was constrained only by my powers because the material was so good. And it was this sort of expressed itself in the writing. One, the quality of the material that was on the cutting room floor when I was done was so good, I think I could make another book of it. That it was, there was so much mm-hmm. stuff that was good. And that usually doesn't happen. It does happen to me that,
Wait, can you give me one example? Do you want to
cutting room floor? Well, I'll give you a whole category of example that after, after the collapse, I was essentially squirreled away inside the Albany Resort in the Bahamas where Sam Bankman-Fried and all his colleagues lived, and had free run of the place and of him. And every day would come back after interviewing him, getting colleagues on the phone, picking through the condominiums they lived in where all their possessions had been left behind. And I would write a journal. Mm-hmm. And the journal was like 2,000 words a day. And it was the stuff, it read so well. It was just so electric, the material, that I thought, well, when I get to this place in the book, I'm just going to be able to just grab this and use it and take it. Mm-hmm. And I ended up using almost none of it. It's its own separate thing that just didn't fit into the book. It's 30,000 words that could almost stand alone as a narrative of a collapse. And I used bits and pieces, but this, like, lots of stuff, just I didn't use it as it was written at the time. That was unusual, that I actually wrote a whole bunch that I thought was great, never stopped thinking was great, but it just slowed down the narrative when I got to it. So I didn't add anything.
That's so interesting, because it can be really fun to immerse yourself in a world, but I understand what the, if the pace is, if you have a certain pace for most of the book, you can't just sort of get people bogged down and change it.
Correct.
Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step three, create a financial goal. $50 every paycheck, or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge, upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to get stronger just around the corner, so you can give everything you've got. Whether you want to crush a few reps before class with our expanded strength equipment or sweat it out on your way home from work. With over 2,800 locations, there's a Planet Fitness close to you, and most are open 24 hours. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends January 30th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
So the being, so that you're texting me, the strength of the thing was I just felt I am limited only by my powers, and the material's that good. And the way, it, so, and what got left out was so good, was that's a good sign. But also, when I got to the back end of the thing, like the last third of the book, it started to write itself, that it was, it, there was, you know, when you're telling a story, when you, there, it's like a jungle, and there are paths through the jungle, and there's more than one path. Mm-hmm. And it takes a while for me, usually when I'm working on something, to figure out what path I want to take. And I have a high degree of uncertainty in the beginning as I'm moving through the jungle. Is there a better, am I, should
I feel the same way.
Right? And so, and I got to the point, it was like I was hacking through the jungle for the first 40 or 50 pages. And then it got, the path got, I thought, I found a soft spot in the jungle. This is actually a great way through the jungle. And then when I got to the last third of the jungle just vanished. It was just like clear sailing. And so,
what was that? What is that inflection point in the book where you think it sort of, it, where it clears, would you say?
when you
or what time frame?
When you turn the page and I've shown up on the scene.
And then you show up and you say something like, it's really easy to steal from Sam Bankman-Fried, that line or
the
something.
The most striking thing about Sam Bankman-Fried was how easy he was to steal from. Yes. And
God, that, and, yes. And then, yes. And you're rifling through his desk or something.
That's right.
Or going through the, and yeah, love
and,
that. Yep.
And from then, so this is something, it only occurred to me after the book was sent off to the printer that had never happened to me. The way I work, I handwrite notes when I'm interviewing people. I put them into my laptop. I type them up that night. And each stage is a sort of a winnowing away. Like, I don't write it down everything they say. I write down what interests me. I don't type up all my notes. So I type up what interests me. There's a sort of that filtering that's going on. And in the end, I've got this giant file, just one fat file.
It's like distilled.
Called Travels. It was called Travels with Sam. And it was 300,000 words. The book's 95,000 words. And I cull from that file, when I am writing the book. But normally what I do, because I'm afraid there was something that I really wanted to do that I didn't do, or some incident I left out, after I'm done, I usually go through that file again and think,
right. And you say, and you go through the glean. Did I leave this out? Did I leave? Yeah.
And I didn't,
right.
I didn't do it this time. In fact, I still have not done it. And I was so sure of where the book was going that I just forgot about the file. And that was a completely new experience. So the challenges, that's the first thing that pops to mind. You say like the strengths of the book is just the quality of the material is so high. I have my limitations as a writer. I bump up against them. You know, it's the best I can do kind of thing. It isn't the problem with the book is not the material. If there's a problem with the book, I don't actually think there's a problem. I think it's my favorite book that I've ever written, but whatever.
I love this. Wait. I want you to, before you go on to the critiques, tell me why it's your favorite book.
It was so.
Is it because it's the most recent one and you always fall in love with your latest?
No, because you actually catch me in the book tour and it's usually when I hate the book the most. After I've been speaking of it for 3 or 4 days. So I'm not in a particularly euphoric state about my book. It was, I thought I was doing lots of things at once and leaving and creating a thing that readers would interact with in a really interesting way. And there was just depths to it.
I see that. I think, and let me just say, the reason why I asked you about some of the critiques is because, and I could articulate them, but I think what I'd like to say instead first is what I think you're saying, and I just want to say it before so you can just nod your head and say, you're totally right. Which is, I think there's a lot of nuance here, and there's more ambiguity in this book. It's a puzzle.
Yes.
And I think what makes it beautiful is that you, as first of all, the story, you know, the access, the details, I think there's that, getting deep into meeting a character who is himself somewhat of an enigma, but that as the reader has to decide.
Yes.
You are not dogmatic. You are not apologetic. You are welcoming us into a world we would not have access to. And I see breadcrumbs. I mean, you use the metaphor of your writing as you're going through, you don't know where you're going in the jungle, and then you saw your path. As a reader, I'm using a forest metaphor, and I see breadcrumbs here.
Yeah.
And I see the breadcrumbs going in places. I see red flags and breadcrumbs, and it leads me not to a place of, I mean, I look at this going, oh, wow, I see a lot of red flags and I see, I'm going to say it differently. There's this, no one is ever, not a judge, not a jury, no human is ever going to get Sam Bankman-Fried to say one way or another, yes, I committed a crime, or yes, I knew that money was being moved from the exchange into the hedge fund and I was doing it to cover the losses. You will never, he doesn't say that in your book, he's never going to say that to anybody.
Correct.
And so at the end of the day, regardless of, you know, the people who have cooperated and regardless of their testimony, even if he is convicted, you will never get probably, I don't think, a confession out of him one way or another. And so what I love about that is that's the nature of our system around trust and around looking at evidence. And I think what your book does is it leaves open that central enigma about anyone who is accused of or involved in something that looks like fraud, which is, did they intend, is this whole thing a sham where they're trying to cheat people, which does not seem to be the case with him, or is it kind of an Achilles heel? And the Achilles heel is a combination of being too devoted to math and numbers and probabilities and also creating chaos around you and falling prey to that as a victim, right? So the question is he sort of like make a mess of things? And, you know, as he said, I fucked up and didn't really have a guilty mind. That might not help him in court, but in terms of the moral weight of it, or instead is that just the conditions he created around himself, someone like Donald Trump, create chaos around me, and then I can do what I want in the chaos. I think that's the question I'm left with after reading this book. Does that make sense?
It does. And it rhymes with something I was thinking, one of a half dozen things I was thinking that were kind of guides for me as I was writing the story, that I never thought I'm going to have any effect on a legal outcome. What I thought was, I thought was there's such a gap between the hot takes you get in about Sam Bankman-Fried in the media, both when things were great mm-hmm. and when things fell apart.
Yep. Okay. Yep.
Such a gap between those takes and what people thought he was and what I thought he was and what I understood. It was such a misapprehension that I thought, if I can jump into that gap and close that gap, so force people to see him for who he is, better or worse, you know, for better or worse, that it's going to cause people possibly to feel about this event differently than they might have felt. It's going to force them to grapple with feelings about this event rather than take a simple off the rack sort of attitude towards it. And that was interesting. I asked my son, it's funny, kind of things are just popping into my head, but I have a 16-year-old son, Walker Lewis. And Walker would listen to me talk about Sam, about the story, about what I thought I might try to do. And he watched me grappling with the book and kind of rides to school. And at one point I said, you know, what do you think the purpose of me writing a book is? And he said, of this book. And he said, I think you might get people to think differently about controversy, I think that there are all these things that happen. There's all this noise that happens when they happen. And everybody kind of hears the noise, internalizes some sort of simple message from it and moves on. That you can show that, like in this case, and so in probably all cases, when Twitter explodes, there's some other thing going on. It's much deeper, richer, more interesting. And you should just, you know, the radical act is to reserve judgment. It's like not to jump in and be sure of one thing or the other. You can make people, so it was interesting. He said, that was his line was, I think you can get people to think differently about controversy. And I thought, that's an interesting take on the purpose of this thing. It wasn't the only purpose, but it became one of the purposes. It's like, that was clearly naturally going to fall out of this story, that you can't have marinated in any of the media around this event. Pick up the book honestly and read it, unless you think I'm like a liar or a fabulist and making stuff up, and come away thinking anything but, I didn't know this. You know, this is more complicated than I thought.
Well, to me, I mean, my brain is like, ooh, there's so many, when you talk about thinking differently about controversy, as you were talking, I was thinking about the way this book makes me think differently about law. I tend to write in the area of sort of, you know, the way law can, my book on the financial crisis yep. was about sort of the deregulation, right, that enabled the toxic mortgage supply, crash. Yep. But I'm thinking here, like you have sort of, you know, when, and it's kind of like the controversy thing, when something, you know, when something implodes and someone's on their way down everyone comes in and circles the corpse and tries to get their piece of it. And, you know, law did not, you know, we have this issue with, you know, how to regulate crypto. And, you know, as folks probably, most folks know, you know, this idea of having a non-fiat, a non-government backed sort of private peer-to-peer currency arose out of the financial crisis in 2008 and that sort of white paper from someone who may or may not exist. And it came from, you know, a lot of this stuff comes from sort of a good place, but at the end of the day, it turned out not to be sort of a decentralized peer-to-peer currency. There was a lot of problems around trust and around, you know, all these different things. But for years and years, you know, we're talking about going back to 2008, the regulators didn't act. I mean, ultimately, you know, as you note in the book, at some point they decide that, okay, we're going to treat something like a pure coin, like Bitcoin, as a commodity, because that's what it seems to be, as opposed to a currency or maybe a security. But then they sort of want to treat these ICOs, these initial coin offerings, just like they're issuing stocks. So maybe that should be regulated as a security. But the regulators just sort of stood back, didn't do much. This thing grows, unlike something like Napster, right? Like when Napster was doing the file sharing of music and it was this giant business, you know, there was a crackdown and then that business was killed and recreated in a way that was within the regulatory frame. Yep. I mean, crypto was allowed to grow and grow and grow. And then when you start having, and because it was growing in the shadows.
In a largely stateless environment, right.
In a largely stateless environment where it was very hard, you know, for the case for crypto was, you know, easier way to transact. You don't have to, you know, rely on the banking system, maybe some anonymity, stable value. In some cases, none of those things turned out to be fully true, but especially not because when you have these folks operating outside of the regulated system, you know, then you're going to find people who are taking advantage. You know, it's not going to all be on the up and up. So all this happens. And then when the crash comes, you know, then the regulators come in and, you know, they find the crimes. You know, I know these statutes well, they're pretty broad. You find the fraud, you prosecute people. And then, as you know, the part I loved in your book, which I hadn't thought about, was a bankruptcy trustee.
Yeah.
Then the bankruptcy trustee comes in doing what they're supposed to do, which is try to claw back as much as they can from the entities that file for bankruptcy. I think it's Alameda as well as the FTX entity. I can't remember, go for bankruptcy, right? So it's a trustee's job to claw all this back. But stuff gets pretty dodgy because if the rule is we want people to be full and fair disclosure about their businesses, honest about the numbers. And one of the big questions is, you know, was SBF fully transparent about, you know, doesn't seem like he was, but he thought it wasn't a big deal, maybe, to be fully transparent. But then we get to this bankruptcy trustee who doesn't really have a great use, as you note in your book, for accurate numbers, like this catch-22 you're describing, where he's trying to claw back money from someone who got a bonus paid in, I forget the name of the
serum
it was that you were.
But yeah, the serum, you know.
And for purpose. Yeah, go ahead. So, you know what I'm saying? Yeah, so, I loved this, like, this gray area. Go ahead.
Backing away from the story a minute.
Okay.
One of the ways I thought about what this book is it's social satire and as engineered by this crypto wonder kid who goes from having no money to having $22.5 billion in about 18 months. And then he starts to,
I'm laughing now. It's like Chauncey.
Yeah.
Gardner,
yeah. And
right?
then,
yeah.
He, and then with his $22.5 billion, because of how he is and how he thinks about the world, he starts stress testing system after system, the system of political donations, the financial system, media, philanthropy. And that's what interests me in the first place. And revealing things about those systems. It was funny to me that even after he collapses, he continues to reveal things about systems, the criminal justice system, but also the bankruptcy system. And I had no idea how the bankruptcy system worked. I didn't know that the SEC used to regulate bankruptcies back in the 70s and 80s, and then they gave it up. And so the only check on bankruptcy, on the bankruptcy people, and bankruptcy is an unbelievably lucrative thing. If bankruptcy lawyers can get their hands on a corpse that's as fat as FTX's, where there's billions and billions of dollars, they can make $1 billion.
Right. And the bankruptcy judge has to approve those fees. But I worked for a law firm that made a lot of money on bankruptcy. I wasn't in that department. So yes, it's very, you want to have your clients do deals, but then once they collapse, you can be there to clean up the mess.
Once they've got the corpse, once it's in the bankruptcy system, several things are going on at once. One is everybody involved is getting paid by the hour. You know, and sometimes it's $2,000 an hour. So the bankruptcy of FTX, they're already at like $400 million in fees charged. And an outside creditor did an analysis for me, and they said it's going to cost $1 billion. Lawyers, advisors are going to make $1 billion off of the bankruptcy of FTX. Mm-hmm. The only check, mm-hmm. now that the SEC isn't supervising this, is this character inside the Department of Justice who's called a bankruptcy trustee. But the bankruptcy who actually filed something, a complaint with the bankruptcy judge in this case, saying these lawyers should not be the lawyers for the bankruptcy. They were the lawyers for FTX before, when everything was good. That they're among other things, they are in possession of lots of criminal evidence, possibly criminal evidence, and they may be implicated. What on earth are they doing running the bankruptcy? But those lawyers actually pushed Sam very hard to file for bankruptcy in the first place, and then seized it as their kind of their business. But the fact that the trustee has no power, that all he can do is is kind of bitch and moan to the bankruptcy judge, and the bankruptcy judge is often himself a former bankruptcy lawyer, it starts to have this whiff of just like these insiders are figuring out how to make as much money as they can. And everybody forgets the purpose of this thing. The purpose of this thing is to get the money back to the creditors, right? And so their incentives are to make it go on as long as possible, make it as complicated as possible, and charge as much as possible. That's different from getting all the monies back to the creditors. And they do things like that are just, seem to me, if you're just an innocent person walking in, insane. So one thing we know about Sam Bankman-Fried's empire was that it was highly chaotic, sloppy, and Sam Bankman-Fried himself would know where some money was in some wallet where no one else did. You would think they would at least interview Sam Bankman-Fried and ask, like, do you know where any money is? But they instantly say, no, we're not going to do that, thus making the job far more complicated and it'll take much more time to do it. But lo and behold, here we are, whatever it is, almost a year later, and of the $8.6 billion in customer deposits that are missing, they've said they found $7.3 billion in liquid assets already. And they're wow, sitting on piles of investments, one of which we know is worth about $1 billion, maybe more. And you look at it and you say, like, in a different world, if there wasn't a human being, if instead of being paid by the hour to make it as complicated and go on as long as possible, you had someone come in and say, you're only going to get paid for the job, get it done as quickly as possible. You wonder if, like, it might not be over now and everybody would have gotten their money back. That doesn't mean that doesn't absolve Sam Bankman-Fried of wrongdoing, but it does cast the whole thing in a different kind of light.
Yeah. And I think to this point, you know, and when you say, well, you know, I thought the role of the trustee is to expand the bankruptcy estate so that the creditors can be made as close to whole as possible, right? Because it's an insolvency. And maybe if there's money left, it could go to the equity holders, which would be, I guess, Gary, in the case of Alameda, Gary and Sam. And in the case of FTX, I think there's more than them, but I'm not sure. But I think that ignores you know, what economists call the agency problem, right? Everyone has their own personal agenda and stake, and there are conflicts of interest inherent in anything. And so this is where I think this leads me back to what I think Sam's biggest Achilles heel was. And this goes to his sort of disdain for reading, mm-hmm. and his respect more for just the numbers and the gamble, is that, you know, he forgot everything he learned when he was kind of winning those sort of wagers on the floor at Jane Street Capitol. Remember the whole wager, like, you know, the mini dice thing example you give, or if someone's asking you the question, what are the odds that I would have, you know, be related to a Major League Baseball player? If someone's asking you that question, they've got some sort of stake in it. And so I think part of maybe the arrogance of youth and being utterly brilliant is sometimes people who are utterly brilliant in one arena cannot see their blind spots in another arena. And that he just dismisses Shakespeare as, well, Shakespeare is not that great because of the probabilities that the greatest writer would have been born then as a percentage of the number of people who lived in the world. And also saying that, also missing the point, thinking that it was Shakespeare's plots that made his writing brilliant, which is not actually what the point was. And he just sort of dismissing all adults. And the thing that he needed were, you know, did he not know? It kind of reminds me of, I'm kind of veering here, but it kind of reminds me of the folks at AIG Financial Products when the, you know, selling credit default swaps. And they're like, they just thought that it wouldn't, they forgot about the margin call.
Yeah.
Right. And so this is the same thing with him. This, he didn't know that bankruptcy could be a margin call. Like he didn't understand that once things, that there was a, that it's not just about the numbers. It's about how it's sort of anthropological and the systems like that you're talking about, as flawed as these other systems are, when power changes hands and he loses control, he doesn't get to dictate the game. It's no longer a video game. And worse than that, they won't let him even play the game. Yeah. And I just don't know that he could see that coming. And that seems to be one of his greatest flaw, I would say.
It's also what makes him interesting as a character, though, because he is a kind of got a Martian-like view of the world and systems.
Mm-hmm.
But a Martian who is contemptuous of humans, and especially grown-up humans, anybody over the age of about 35. So he is almost assumes coming out of the block that, I don't know, when he's trying to figure out how to influence an election with money, that nobody who's ever thought about it has anything to say that's useful. And they're going to go figure it out. They're going to go figure it out on their own. And when you do this, two things happen. You make a lot of stupid mistakes because there are a lot of things you could have just avoided because someone actually could have told you don't do that and you should have listened to them. But every now and then you find something that other people don't see.
Absolutely.
And very broadly in the life of Sam Bankman-Fried, you could see why he gets more and more confident in his approach to life because by the age of 29, he's the richest person in the world under 30. He said that his, you know, yeah, there were mistakes, but on balance, this is really working for me. And in addition, he's psychologically incapable of being anything else. Like he just taking on board any kind of like external wisdom just is not in his repertoire. But it does create, this is one simple explanation to what happened. And it's the explanation given to me by the Bahamas regulator, the person who coaxed Sam Bankman-Fried to the Bahamas in the first place. Her name was a woman named Christina Roll. Basically she said, you know, if you made me put this into a sentence, Sam needed grown-ups. He needed grown-ups in his world and he didn't have any grown-ups in his world. That's an oversimplification. There's a lot more going on, but it was certainly true that the boring and firm accountant in the middle of FTX or Alameda in the beginning of 2021 would have prevented this ever from happening. That there were so many ways for this not to happen the way it went down. It just required someone to sort of impose some norms, some of the norms of grown-up financial life upon the company. And your point about regulators, I mean, the regulatory approach, which had the effect of kind of turning all crypto people into pirates, the way they would regulate, they wouldn't really be very clear about what you could do. They would just fine you if you did something that they didn't like, but never really establishing a framework for it meant that any serious reputable grown-up was always a little uncomfortable getting too close to crypto. So they kind of created an environment which the grown-ups were not going to show up. It's a little overstating it, but they had that effect.
And that's also because, you know, because of the accounting wasn't really clear. You know, it's kind of, if you're a regulator and you put your fingerprints on something and you can't see it all, then you could be held.
Oh, I can understand exactly why they've done what they've done. It's a hairball and you'd rather just turn, not have to deal with it. Hope it all falls apart. But once the market value of crypto is $3 trillion And you've got these social forces at play, and the social forces take the form of people like Sam Bankman-Fried with, you know, tens of billions of dollars at the disposal, doing every which of influencing the society every which way. You kind of got to do something, I think.
Well, that's the thing. And, you know, you note that finally Janet Yellen, Treasury Secretary, was looking into this. And this, you know, as someone who's very interested in, you know, the intersection between the sort of so-called traditional regulated banking system and shadow banking, it's always the contagion effect, right? We're always afraid of, well, what if some of the money, the actual real money that was invested in some of these things, you know, to put in reserve was put in sort of really solid assets, right? And any fire sale, which happens even when a fully regulated system, when there's any kind of bank run, it could be interest rate change, anything that requires that triggers people pulling their money out of a system could force the sale of assets. And that could have a sort of downward spiraling effect on the whole economy. And yet, you know, regulators can't see through these kind of quasi banks. And so it's kind of a similar story that we've seen before. And that's kind of like, you know, and I get why in some ways we can say these folks are pirates, but, you know, same things going on in investment banking. Those risks have happened before. Yep. Too, a similar bubble. The thing about Sam that I find super interesting, though, are the things that, you know, both his the Santa Claus problem.
Five years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
So, you know, in terms of the Santa Claus, you know, like I never believed in, spoiler alert, people, we're talking about Santa Claus, okay? So, yeah, I never believed in Santa Claus. Maybe it's because I'm Jewish and it just wasn't a thing, although we had, you know, we had the gifts, but I always knew it was my parents. And like, who in the world, I mean, I don't understand why anyone would think it would be actually possible for someone to fly around and go through all the chimneys. Not everybody has chimneys. How many Santa Clauses would there be? Like, it never made any sense to me. So I'm sympathetic to that. And also this idea, I liked this idea that he thought, well, okay, fine, it's just kids who are brainwashed. And then he realized how much Santa Claus was like a gateway drug to the idea of believing in a kind of white, you know, a white bearded god. I mean, the similarities are just right there in your face. And, you know, the idea of mass delusion, I mean, you know, you can understand in the abstract some of these ideas. And so therefore, in reality, you know, is any kind of fiat currency not backed by gold, you know, inherently a Ponzi scheme? I'm not going to go to these abstractions because I think about these things all the time. So I'm sympathetic to him up until the point, though, where I don't see that he always can distinguish between levels of mass delusion. Like, some mass delusions are so hardwired that we're going to continue with those, and others are just too new for people. Anyway, it's just a
thought. You said, you know, this the difference maybe between you and Sam Bankman-Fried, apropos of Santa Claus, is that Sam Bankman-Fried, when he realizes some of his lower school classmates believe in Santa. You know, he'd heard of Santa. Like, he thought of Santa like Bugs Bunny, like a character. This is on TV. But when he realizes, right, Christmas is coming and all of his classmates are expecting this guy to go down their chimney and leave them presents and all the rest, he's blown away. Like, it really bothers him. So it isn't just he doesn't believe, right, in Santa. It's that other people believe in Santa. drives him up a wall. He sits in his room, thinks about it for days. Like, what does this say about people? It's so funny to think about a little kid having that kind of response. Yeah. It isn't. It's sort of like, what are these people, these human beings I've been right. with? What else is rattling around in their heads? It's a moment.
Go ahead.
No, but Ed.
No, it's funny because I use that metaphor sometimes. I think about, you know, Santa Claus to me has always been a nice metaphor for things like other things like money, because, you know, on the one hand, we can say Santa Claus doesn't exist, like you and I think that. But on the other hand, it's a multi-billion dollar industry, Santa Claus. Yeah. So Santa Claus really kind
hundreds of billions, probably. Yes. So yeah. Santa Claus, you know, yes, we willed into existence with our material greed.
Yeah, but some of the other flags are, I forgot who the character was. It wasn't out of Sam's mind. It was one of the other folks who was like, you know, law is kind of, you know, you don't really have to follow the, this is when they needed to get someone to be a front trader for them, I think in Korea. And yep. I think it was Nishad, kind of treating law like it was optional. And this is like on page 92. Yep. This is one of the breadcrumbs that I think you put in there.
Thank you very much for noticing it. Thank you for noticing it. You're the first one to bring. There are a bunch of these breadcrumbs, and that is one of the breadcrumbs. You are absolutely right. So you want to go ahead and read it?
Do you want to read that?
I don't have it. You go ahead and do it.
Okay, I got it. So it says that when they got it kind of involved and they had to use a crypto exchange in Korea, because that was kind of the only place that they could.
Let's explain why.
Oh yeah, say,
so
say yeah.
What they were doing is this is before they create their exchange. They're trying to arbitrage crypto prices, and Bitcoin in South Korea is trading at a 30% premium to Bitcoin in America. They want to sell Bitcoin in South Korea and buy it in America and clear 30% profit. Risklessly. The problem is they need to have an account on the Korean exchange, and to be on a South Korean crypto exchange, you have to be South Korean. So that's they hire some graduate student who they know to front them and pretend to be them, which is probably illegal, almost certainly illegal.
Right. It reminds me kind of like I don't know the laws in Korea, right? So it reminds me of like Michael Milken and the parking stuff. But okay, so this is quoting Nishad. He said, it was borderline illegal, but in practice, who goes after you when you do this? No one. That's where I learned what the law is. The law is what happens, not what is written. So he's an ultimate legal realist. And he's also reflecting how, yeah, people can get away with things until they don't. But this is such
such a red flag. And he's also 26 years old and has never had any experience in life except for working for this crypto company. Yeah.
I mean, I think the reason why I'm able to see these breadcrumbs and red flags is because when I was right out of law school in my 20s, the firm life was too intense, and I got this really sweet job working as an in-house counsel at this marketing company in Stamford, Connecticut. I was doing a reverse commute from New York. And come to find out a couple of years later that these folks were literally cooking the books. And the company was called Sendin, and it was like the largest stock drop in U.S. history when the truth came out. It was like, and I you know, it's
you
really
were working,
awful
you
to
were
be a
working,
young person
you were working. Working for them when it happened.
Yes.
And you didn't sense it.
Oh, this is the thing. I went back, Michael, and there were these red flags, you know, these little things, because it was a very small company. We had merged with a big company in New Jersey, and we were the small, scrappy startup in Connecticut. And there were little flags that I noticed in the way that, you know, I was young, but I didn't think much about it. And I went back in my mind, you know, and revisited those. Was I ignoring these signs? And I think, I think I was, you know, and I think I just liked, I think I always had this side of me that was like, you know, I'm more creative than most lawyers. I want to be, you know, where the action is. I'd rather be, you know. And so I just didn't know. There was nothing that anyone told me to do that was illegal, but it was like these little subtle things that were kind of, you know, it's like you're the boiled frog, like little things that I felt like they were turning the heat up. And yeah, ultimately our chairman, Walter Forbes, went to prison, but he was tried three times. There were two hung juries, and it turns out it was Chris Christie who brought that case.
Oh.
Anyway, so I'm aware of, and these people were perfect. Yeah, only two people went to prison. It's a long story, but And, you know, I definitely look back on that. And I think that started my interest in white collar crime, because you could never have known that these folks were crooks. And I think looking back, one of these red flags was someone, I don't want to name who the person is because this person didn't go to prison, but they would speak about things like, well, is that really material? The thing that they were doing, this is stuff a lot of companies were doing back in the 90s, which was they would have these pooling mergers. Yep. I don't know if you know this whole thing. And so that you could like merge with another company, and if it was treated as a pooling, you didn't have to write down to book value the assets you were buying. You could just act as if you owned them all the time. And then they had these giant merger reserves. So the merger reserves, let's say whatever, they're doing a merger and you're supposed to use a merger reserve. You set it aside as a bookkeeping item to say, you know, we had legal costs, we had integration of systems costs, whatever. And so that you would have pro forma financials where you would say, look, we earned X per share, other than the fact that we had this merger, which means we lost a little bit. But what they were really doing is drawing down against the merger reserve regular operating expenses. This was the cookie jar stuff that everyone was doing. Arthur Levitt talked about it at the time. I knew nothing about finance when I went there to be a marketing lawyer. And then I left there. I stayed around after the forensic audits ended, and I went and worked at Fidelity Investments for two reasons. One, because now I was fascinated with how money worked. And two, because the name Fidelity, I was like, well, that's going to, you know, clean up my resume, because I didn't want this send it on my resume forever. But anyway, so that was my story. So I look at this and I look at this. That's why I see all of these red flags.
But take your experience and try to imagine porting you in out of college or law school or wherever you're coming from into crypto. And so your first experience in the world is this whole other world that has essentially no real rules or regulations. It has norms.
I would have been living in the condo in the Bahamas.
You wouldn't have known what was normal and what was not normal. You would have been normal to crypto.
Nope.
Rather than the world didn't touch the normal world. And everybody's 26 years old everybody's getting rich.
I should say that this company I was working for was an early e-commerce company, right? And so if they had been honest, the sad truth of it is people said later, if Walter Forbes had been honest about what was really going on in the books, you know, it could have been a company like Amazon. I mean, we owned Match.com at one point. We owned, that was a whole other bunch of legal issues, let me tell you. But we were a young and up and coming, you know, e-commerce company. And anyway, and you're right. I can see these people are so young, and you're right, they're only around young people. So this is, you know, so now I want to ask you, I guess there's two threads before we go that I want to pick up. Okay, so one has to do with my having met Joe McGinnis years ago, well before I had a podcast, before there are podcasts. And as you know, he was the author of Fatal Vision. Have you met Joe before?
Never met him.
So I love the book Fatal Vision because I read it right after I read, I love Truman Capote. Yep. Like I'm a huge
true crime
narrative nonfiction. Yeah. And so I don't read that stuff anymore as much. But when I read Fatal Vision about his take on Jeffrey McDonald, you know, allegedly, I guess he's been convicted of murdering his wife in 1970. And then I later read Janet Malcolm, who wrote for The New Yorker, her critique of that, right? It's called The Journalist and the Murderer. And there was an ethical critique because my understanding is McDonald had hired McGinnis to write a book about him. And sort of halfway through the project, McGinnis decided, oh, this guy is guilty.
Right.
And wrote that book. And he ended up getting sued. And then it ended up setting a lot of court. And McDonald is still in prison. Sadly, McGinnis, he passed away, I think, 2 years after I met with him in 2014, unrelated to my meeting with him, I swear.
That makes me feel safer.
But that's an... No, don't worry. Don't drink the, but it was some kind of cancer. But, after he tried to do that Sarah Palin book, remember he moved in next to her house and tried to... So that's a situation, and he was heavily criticized for that. And then I think about...
For turning on his subject.
And so I guess I would ask you, I'm assuming that you were not hired by Sam.
Oh my God. What a funny idea. The way it happened. Yeah, I mean, I explain how it happens. A friend asked me to meet with him and evaluate him for his business deal. And I had no idea who he was or what FTX was. And he turns up on my porch in Berkeley, California, and talks to me for 2 hours. And at the end of the 2 hours, I just said, can I just hang around and watch? I just want to see what's going to happen here. It's so outrageous what's happened to you already. So that's how it starts. And no, I know, didn't pay me any money, didn't give me FTX shares. No, I wasn't. No, that would be disaster. That'd be a disaster.
And not worth. I know. I mean, that would be.
I don't need any more money.
I didn't think so. That didn't seem like your kind of your style. But the point is, like, now we're in, so this pivots to the next part, which is now, you know, I think that I read somewhere that you'd sold the film rights, and when the movie is made, assuming, or when the screenplay is written, we're going to have the trial in the rear view mirror. And I wonder what that does, how that's going to, I know you had this other stuff on the cutting room floor, but that's sort of a different narrative. But do you think at some point, I mean, how do you, because if the whole point of this book leaves ambiguity, what are you going to do next?
I may write a 150-page book about the trial and about his.
Okay.
But it seemed really clear to me, since the book was about this person's ambition to make infinite dollars to solve some huge existential problems.
Right.
Of existence.
The effect of altruism, which we haven't talked about.
Once that collapsed and this whole empire collapsed and we were in Ozymandias land. I just thought, that's the end of the story. That's the end of this story. There's this other story that's about to start, like how the society processes him legally. And how will a movie deal with it? Probably with like a little black card at the end. Like Sam Bankman-Fried is now in jail for 120 years or whatever it is.
I don't think it's going to be 120, given the sentencing guidelines. My prediction is anywhere between 6 and 11 years.
Really?
Is that too
well,
low?
I can tell you.
You think 20?
I don't know anything about this, but except that I interviewed a woman who had been a prosecutor until very recently in that same office in the Southern District of New York, who is now a defense lawyer. And I asked her before the trial started, if you were defending him, what would you have accepted what would have excited you as a plea deal? Like, what would the government have if they'd offered it? You say, we got to take it. And she said 10 years. So she thought he would be very lucky if he got in a plea deal 10 years. So he's facing, like, in theory, 120.
Well, yeah.
But
happens on the guidelines, if you've looked at those charts.
What is also going on is the judge decides the sentence. The jury decides whether he's guilty. And
it's Judge Kaplan, too.
And the judge has expressed immense irritation with him. The judge clearly is not, like, on his side. Judges seems almost a little hostile. So I don't know where that leads.
I love Judge Kaplan. The trouble is, you know, people are on paper innocent till proven guilty, but it's not great when everyone who worked with you is testifying that they committed crimes.
It's also not great. I mean, innocent, it is a curious stat. Innocent till proven guilty. Last year, there were 77,000 people charged by the federal government with crimes. 99.6% were either pled guilty or lost in court and were convicted. Only 0.4% were acquitted. So either the federal prosecutors are unbelievably gifted at identifying who's guilty before they take them to court, or the system is actually kind of skewed against the defendant.
I have a book for you to read. My friend, I had her on the show, Carissa Byrne Hessick, wrote a book called Punishment Without Trial, Why a Plea Bargain is a Bad Deal. And she talks about, the part of the reason why, you know, the statutes you're talking about, if you add it all up, they really want these very, very long sentences because they become a bargaining tool.
Right.
Because there aren't enough resources to try everybody.
Right.
But it really does deprive people
of their
right to a trial. I mean, and this is someone who, I mean, you know, this is someone super wealthy, though, right? What she's talking about is if you don't have money, especially if you're middle class as opposed to poor, where they're going to give you counsel, you have to.
So the truth about
you're going to bankrupt your whole family.
I think they've already bankrupted Sam's family. I think they're out of money. They're basically out of money for the lawyers. So he's not a really rich person now fighting this. But you're right. Unless you're a really rich person, you're facing someone with unlimited resources. And there's some rules that are kind of skewed against you. You will understand this. I don't completely. But it was surprising to me how much easier it was for the government to force someone to testify or compel someone to testify than it was for Sam's lawyers. The Sam's lawyers can kind of ask, could you please come back from China and sit on a witness stand and say something about this? And the person can just say no, and they can't really get him out of China.
In terms of getting a subpoena.
Yeah, and the government prosecutors very easily got people are getting people into the courtroom.
I do feel awful for his parents, which is a whole other situation. And I know that it would be shocking to me that they thought they were engaged in any kind of fraud. And so I'm just so confused about that. But given that Sam is a good game player and a really good gambler, it would surprise me if he didn't have some money stashed away somewhere for his effective altruism pursuits later. Would it surprise you to find out that later that there was some offshore entity somewhere that had a bank account somewhere just as a sort of safety
in his name?
Not in his name, in the name of some kind of shell company
that he had control over. That was like a big pile of money. Mm-hmm. It would surprise me. It wouldn't shock me. It would surprise me, though. Yes. One is that just like the nature of his enterprise, there was money in wallets in obscure crypto exchanges. I mean, when they're falling apart, they get a call from a local bank in the Bahamas saying you have an account with $300 million in it. And they didn't even know it. Mm-hmm. So it's this John Ray, the bankruptcy people are still finding money all over the place. So
the answer is yes, then. Yeah. I mean, in other words, they don't know.
And FTX people have told me there's no way they're going to find all the money we know in these wallets. You'd have to have all of us there helping them find it. There's no way we're going to find all the stuff. And so there's stuff out there. It's like, you know what it is? It's like an unbelievably complicated Easter egg hunt. And the kids come back and the adults can't remember where they put the eggs. And there are six eggs at the end of the hunt that nobody ever finds. I wouldn't be surprised if there's six eggs after the hunt that no one ever finds. Do I think that Sam, in a really diabolical way, like took $500 million, stuck it somewhere, and he's got access to it? I asked, you know, the people closest to him about this. And some said yes and some said no. So everybody had a different view. I would bet no. But I wouldn't give you great odds.
So if it's not diabolical, it could be absent-mindedly.
Oh, yeah, totally. That could have happened.
Well, thank you so much for your time, Michael.
All right, Jen. All right. Thank you. Thanks for reading it. Bye.
I really enjoyed that conversation with Michael Lewis. As you know, I have already had on the podcast the co-author of Easy Money, Ben McKenzie. So we've already talked a little bit about crypto. And so this is the second book focusing on that entire industry and its implosion. And after today, when we're covering Going Infinite by Michael Lewis, we will also, in a future podcast, be talking about Number Go Up when I'm in conversation with author Zeke Foe. So between these three episodes, I'm hoping that listeners get different takes on the individuals involved and what went down. I think what's super interesting about Michael Lewis's book is that, as he notes, he had unusual access, not just to Sam Bankman-Fried, but to many of the players surrounding him at Alameda Research and FTX, the two businesses that he had majority ownership of and control. And I also think it's really good, as I think he said his son said, is that you're getting with this book a different kind of take on controversy. This book makes you do the hard work. You as a reader have to follow the breadcrumbs and make your own determination about what went down. Michael is reporting what he sees, and he's not making out any of the folks involved in a sort of black or white way. I think it's utterly fascinating for that reason. I also like where we landed, which is given that Michael has said in the book and in our conversation that Sam Bankman-Fried knows where all bunch of these crypto type wallets are that have, you know, tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions of dollars in them. And as he noted, you know, the bankruptcy trustee, he believes, should have asked Sam where that was. The failure to do so means that that money is out there somewhere. And so I guess I would say, you know, whether or not we say it's diabolical or just careless, to the extent that he knows, if Sam actually knows there's money out there, there really is nothing stopping him, I think, from letting his lawyers know that and having his lawyers communicate that. I'm not sure if he's not allowed to go on. I mean, obviously, he is now in custody and he's not allowed to go on the internet now. And I think that's part of the problem. And I know he has no access to the company system, but if he jogs his memory and he actually believes the numbers are not adding up and there must be some more somewhere, I hope that that's something that he can bring forward. Otherwise, I think a lot of us are going to be wondering about how much is stashed away somewhere. So thank you for joining us, and I will be back next week with another show as we continue to explore the writing process and the nonfiction world together. Let us know what you think. Send an email to bookedup@politicon.com, and you can also write to us at bookedup, P.O. Box 147, Northampton, Massachusetts, 01061. To keep up with the show and our featured authors, follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And please give Booked Up a 5-star review. It really will help other people find the podcast.